Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is the first AI Legends podcast. My name is Joe Connors, and I have two great guests on. My first guest is Mr. Professor Podcast himself, Kalen Green. How you doing, pal?
I'm all right, Joey. Thanks. Thanks for that wonderful intro. You're the only person that calls me Professor Podcast, but I'm going to take it.
It's because you're a beast, my friend. You're amazing. Beast. And my second guest is Hatem. And I want to say your last name is Kadus, but if I mess that up, you tell me now.
You got it spot on.
Brilliant.
Nice.
So how are you guys doing today?
All good, all good. Just had a really big Sunday lunch. So completely fueled up, carbo loaded for this pod, locked into place. Ready to go. Really exciting topic. It's such a good idea, this series. It's a legend series. So, I mean, it's going to be from a lot of different places, but to start off with Muhammad Ali, who means so much to so many people. I could probably talk about this all day. I actually have done that before. I have talked about Muhammad Ali for an entire day before. So, really excited to see what happens on the pod.
I mean, the word legend is overused quite a lot, but, when it comes to, there is in the sport of boxing and, we're going to talk about it later, but the way he crossed over into politics in everyday life. I mean, Muhammad Ali is the ultimate. I mean, every young, old should know who he is, will know at least one facet of his life. And unfortunately, it's quite in the topic because he passed away recently as well. So it should be a really good conversation as well.
Brilliant, guys. So again, Kay, you touched on this is the Anfield Index Legend Show. And I just want to say for anybody listening out there, I'm hosting today, but I will not host all these. All you have to do is go to Gags, present him with any sporting legend in your eyes. I went to Gags months ago and said, hey, we're going to start doing this. I'd love to do Muhammad Ali if you would be cool with it. Came back later and said, let's rock and roll. So remember, this is open to anybody.
Sorry, Sin, you've set the ball rolling because I've been hustling about Mike Tyson as well. So.
All right, gentlemen. So without further ado, let's get this party started. And I do want to say in the beginning, we are going to start with a little intro with Ali. And we are going to talk about his boxing career. But I think it'd be an injustice to not talk about Ali and all the other great things he's done and what he's meant to other people. So I'll start with Kay first. Talk to me a little bit about Ali's life and his boxing career.
Ali, I got to say, for me, Ali means... He means so much more than boxing, as you said. This is something a lot like Liverpool Football Club that my father shared with me and that his father shared with him. For me, growing up in apartheid South Africa, to have an idol like that, and you must remember at that time, my father supported Liverpool. Nowadays, you have games on TV all the time. My dad would have to wait two or three times a year where before the main attraction in a cinema, they would play the highlights of a completely random Liverpool game in black and white, people running around in their short shorts and the horrible muddy fields. And that's the first time you got to see this. And they would have Ali fights in the cinema and that kind of thing. But at this period, you know, at that period of the history of my country, where you had people of color, black people specifically, being so badly treated, somebody like Muhammad Ali to come up and to take just everything by the scruff of the neck the way he did was absolutely insane. It was a Jesse Owens moment. You know, it was something so completely beyond us. Nobody could ignore it. And, but on top of that, I think, you know, I know we're not talking about his boxing that much, but I don't know if I could really think of that many other sporting people who were, while also at the absolute pinnacle of their entire sport, maybe ever, to also do this type of thing socially, culturally. I know boxing is spoiled for choice along those measures, but even within boxing, Ali stands out as really only one or two or three names. That brings an intense cultural credence to this man. His name is spoken like nobody else's, really. In South Africa, of course, you know, growing up in the 80s during apartheid and stuff like that, political people were heroes to us. And then sort of not much beyond that. So people who were in exile and people who were taken into prison, they were the names your parents taught you as really great people. And on top of that, you had one or two sporting heroes. And that's the power of sport. And everybody, literally everybody in this country knows who Muhammad Ali is. And I would venture to say that every poor person across the entire world knows who Muhammad Ali is. That's the incredible immensity of this man's legacy. So it's really, really special.
And that is a great perspective to have. You have a man who lives in K himself in South Africa, who that just goes to show you the global appeal and what Muhammad Ali means to so many people. That right there is the essence of Anfield Index. You have an American, a man who lives in London, a man who lives in South Africa talking about that's the greatest part about this. It's not three guys who live next to each other going, hey, what do you think about Ali? Hey, what do you think about Ali? So that is such a cool thing, Kay. Now, Atem, same question to you.
So I've grown up in a household where football and boxing are very close to my heart. My dad, I'm Egyptian born. So I was born in Egypt. I live in London. My parents been raised in Egypt. And football for me has always been massive, hence the Liverpool thing. And the second thing for me has always been boxing. My dad is a massive, massive Muhammad Ali fan. He actually was lucky enough to attend Rumble in the Jungle. She keeps going on at me when I try and attend my Vegas fights. She's like, yeah.
Still, that's crazy, though. That is crazy.
That's the hilarious thing is whenever I go, yeah, Dad, I went to see Floyd. He's like, yeah, whatever. I went to see Rumble in the Jungle. I raise you. And now, in terms of age group, my age group is Muhammad, is Mike Tyson. And I used to always go, Mike Tyson this, Mike Tyson that. And my dad kept drumming into me the, Muhammad Ali. He gave me he showed me like videotapes back in the day of all the stuff they had on him. And it's only when Muhammad Ali is not just a boxer. Like Mike Tyson is a boxer. And Muhammad Ali is more than a boxer. The more you read about him, the more the racism. And again, I'm Muslim again. So to have a Muslim effectively superstar is something great that the entire Islamic world can lift. You know, I know we're going to touch on the Islamic stuff later on, but there aren't that many superhero, Muslim heroes out at the moment, given what's happening to the religion and the publicity around it. So for Muhammad Ali, through all he achieved and through all he did, there is not a Muslim who doesn't know who he is. And we're talking Africa, Asia, Europe, America, South America. I mean, everybody knows he is. I mean, they even made a skit about him on Coming to America. That's how hilarious he is. But yeah, I mean, it's when you appreciate and you read about him that you know that he is by far the greatest. Like the Floyds can talk the talk, but he set the scene for the trash talking. He did it with style. You look at Floyd, even if we're talking near history, look at Conor McGregor in the UFC, the way they trash talk. All of it came down from Muhammad Ali. I don't think he was the greatest boxer ever, but he was more than a boxer, so he's the greatest ever.
Those are excellent points. Well, that's a great start to this podcast. So we're going to move on a little bit. And you know what? We'll switch up a little bit because you did talk about Islam. Ali converting to Islam in 1964. So back in the 60s, That was unheard of for an American who was obviously born Cassius Clay, didn't want his slave name per se in his own words, so wanted to convert to Islam. Now, I know you guys will probably both remember, but when he first tried to, it was actually to convert to Islam. It was before 64, but the Nation of Islam was not comfortable with that because he was a boxer. And then obviously he was let in eventually. But how do you guys feel about him converting to Islam and its effect that it had on an American society, society in general, and to fans of Ali? Hatem, I'll stick with you.
Being a Muslim, one of the biggest differences is this whole Nation of Islam thing. So I can understand in America at the time, the civil rights movement. And I mean, he's got one of his most famous speeches, which he quotes he gave on Parkinson, where he just won the gold medal and he went to a restaurant thinking, yeah, I'm the Olympic gold medal. I've represented my country. I'm going to walk into a restaurant that usually is basically whites and black segregation. And he walks into the restaurant. He says, whoever's working in the restaurant says, sorry, we don't serve Negroes. And he goes, well, I don't eat them either. So one of his greatest things. And that gives you an indication of how bad the civil rights were. So already a problem with black culture, black famous sportsmen at the time. But he exacerbated it even more by then converting to Islam. So Nation of Islam is different from Islam. Nation of Islam believe that a guy called Elijah Muhammad is a prophet that was sent down, or a messenger that was sent down to help the black people through their troubles of strife. So it's interesting that initially they actually refused them entry because they're a very publicity hungry organization. And by him joining, that instantly gave them the massive publicity, but it also turned a lot of people against them as well. So a lot of people went, by the time he fought Sonny Liston, were already dead against this brash Negro American that was also like is a Muslim as well. Islam was seen in those days not quite as badly as it is at the moment with a bit of the Islamophobia did start off in the 60s. So it was a massive brave move. The whole slave name, a lot of black Americans believed that they were given slave names that way. And I mean, you've only got to look to one of his best friends growing up, Malcolm X. And him, Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali were very tight. Malcolm X was also not very publicly well liked because of one of the, he was part of the Nation of Islam. He was effectively the poster boy of the Nation of Islam. And then came the death of Kennedy and he came up with a very bad quote about Kennedy when he said, oh, when the chickens come home to roost, about the assassination of Kennedy. So he was already alienated by the Nation of Islam. And when Muhammad Ali was with Nation, he was tarnished with the same brush. And again, it wasn't the most publicly, Ali won people over with his boxing rather than his, the affiliation to Nation Islam, but it was a very brave move in a very difficult time for black America.
Yeah, that is great knowledge on that, Hatem. Thank you. That was, actually some stuff I didn't even know. So
I'm going to say one of his biggest regrets has always been his, due to him following sticking to Elijah Muhammad's ways, is that once Malcolm X was alienated, Muhammad Ali was told not to associate with Malcolm X. And that's if you read, one of Muhammad Ali's biggest regrets was the fact that when Malcolm X got assassinated, that he hadn't made his peace with him.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And you listeners, you're starting to see what this man was up against, what he stood up for. And that's difficult. I mean, it's a difficulty that me as a white male will never understand. I can read about it in 100,000 history books, but I'll never understand it. So, okay, talk to me a little bit more about converting to Islam.
Yeah, I think you have to go a bit even before that to understand the immensity of what Muhammad Ali was doing at that time and what he was going through. It was almost, how can I put it? It's almost not a choice, if I can put it that way. And I'll try to explain a little bit more about what's going on. But basically, Ali goes to win, like Hatem says, obviously everybody knows he won his gold medal. He turned professional, I think, like a month after that, threw away his gold medal after not being served in that restaurant. And at this stage, even before that, he was really starting to question what it is to be black, who he was, what kind of person he is. And so the name Cassius Clay, it comes from a very famous abolitionist, one of Abraham Lincoln's good friends. But this is the very difficult part about all this. And we're going to keep on running into this. So maybe it's a good time to deal with this. But But things are not done in society because they're ethical. Generally, things are done because it's better for the people in power. And that's been the story sort of all our, you know, general modern history. And the reason why I say that is because people think slavery, for example, was abolished because it was the ethical thing to do. It wasn't. It was done because it was the economically better thing to do. And people like Cassius Clay, who was an abolitionist, believed that scientifically white people were superior to black people. So we saw this, and I know this as well. In South Africa, there was an immense, huge debate about whether apartheid should continue from the white people in power, because is this their religious duty to confine black people, or should we go the other way, which is we need more money, and the way to make more money is we can't keep the system going. So he read up on that, and he read that Cassius Clay, despite the fact that everybody was telling him, this is a famous abolitionist. Do you know your name? Your name is from a famous abolitionist. He was Abe Lincoln's very good friend, and he freed the slaves, and he's a great man. And so he read up on it, and he thought, this is not a great man. This name, I should not carry this name. And so he becomes this boxer, and we see I think he started boxing training when he was 12. 5 years later, he's turning professional, basically. He's at the Olympics 5 years later, sort of. And it's very obvious he's got this talent for it. And now it's a problem. He's got an immense talent. He's starting to do things that boxers not really doing. He's starting to take things from like middleweight, welterweight, and put them into the heavyweight, which you're not supposed to physically really do at that time. And I can say at this point, boxing is a sport of sluggers. These are street fighters and people who literally stand in the ring beating each other. Right? I'm not trying to demean anybody by saying that, but there was no science to this. Not no science, but there was a lot less science than there is now. You had bruises, sort of people with insanely huge punches. If you had the biggest punch, if you could take the biggest punch, you would win the fight. That was a thing. That was Sonny Liston. Was an absolute monster, right? And so here you have this young black kid coming out, beating Sonny Liston, who is a very comfortable champion because Sonny Liston had a lot of stuff going on. Rumors had it, you know, casinos and gambling and mafia and all that kind of thing. But there was no way that he was going to lose to this young upstart, Muhammad Ali. The odds were 7-1, which were greater odds than when Ali defended his title against Cleveland Williams, for example. So he comes, he beats Sonny Liston, and he starts talking this stuff, and he does it in a way that no one's seen before. So you have all these things happening, and the discomfort is sort of growing when you have somebody doing all these things that are not normal. It's easy for the people who are sort of in, you know, comfort zones and that kind of thing, who are told that people do things this way and other people don't do things this way. Now they're starting to get uncomfortable. Then he decides to convert to Islam and immediately changes his name to I think it was Muhammad X or Cassius X. I can't remember now. But at that stage, I think it must have been like all of white America at that point must have just shut themselves, because already you had this guy who was talking about being the greatest, doing it in a way that nobody else had done. And now changing to Islam later. You know, I completely agree with what Hatem said there. That the Brotherhood of Islam, it's a controversial organization. And we can see, particularly if you look into the journey of Malcolm X through there and how he comes out the other side. And I think this is where we must start understanding what Muhammad Ali was going through at this time. He felt that this way was the way to best represent his people and to best represent his conscience. He's turned to Islam as an extension of his conscience. And because it was not the religion partially of mainstream America, I think that was a factor. But the bigger factor is, Islam is literally, it's a religion of peace. The word that appears least in the Quran is jihad. And it's like as the absolute last resort. We've got a lot of misinterpretations about what Islam means nowadays, but at that time it was the same. Now, I don't know if you can imagine it, but like today, if you had a big athlete coming out, like Serena Williams, like Usain Bolt, a really top black athlete coming out and saying things, especially like Serena does, twerking and loving black culture and saying things about black culture. And we still have this debate now. It happened during the US Open recently. Should men get paid more than women? Why are we having this debate? Men should definitely get paid more than women. When we talk about, when we see Serena Williams loving black culture, it really affects people. And that's, it's 2016 and people are saying you shouldn't be doing that. This is not about race. It absolutely is about race. It's always been about race because race has been the thing that defines Serena Williams since she was born. It's not like sort of a white person growing up in America where you're the majority, where all things are in your cultural direction. You don't have to go outside your comfort zone to enjoy everything or to partake in particular things. And we have this in the 1960s. Where like it was okay to call black people nigger in the press, you know, and so all these things are starting to happen. It was massive. Muhammad Ali changing to Islam, absolutely, completely. Today it wouldn't have been as big, and people converting to Islam is sort of okay. The Islam as a religion has the phobia around it, but back then it was being black, it was being brash, it was being different. It was having the lip, and then he turned to Islam. I mean, honestly, I would not be surprised to hear that like the CIA were after him or something like that. It caused absolute repercussions around the world.
That was awesome, Kay. And it's funny you bring about the CIA. He actually was, I believe, tapped up by the FBI at one time. But that's a great segue into talking about Ali's courage to stand up to racism in the 1960s civil rights movement in America. Now, I myself, white male living in America, grew up in an all-black neighborhood, poor neighborhood. So I know what it's a little bit like to see some racism. And guys, I gotta say, we know racism is all over, still rampant. It doesn't really matter what anybody says because I see it, you guys see it, you see it in mainstream media. You talked about Serena. I'm a huge Serena Williams fan. But there are many people who will not like her, just the color of her skin, because she's not white America. White America looks at everything. And not everybody. I don't want to put everybody in the pigeonhole people, but a lot of white America look at everything like you're not doing the things that we do, that we like. So I'm going to criticize you. You're too brash. You're too cocky. I don't like it.
You know what's a good example, Joey, very, very quickly, is this Beyonce Lemonade album that came out. And at that point, a lot of people came out and said, "This, what is this album? It's not talking to me. I don't understand. You can't just release an album like that. This album is problematic. It's inciting violence," is what Piers Morgan said. Yeah. we know what we think about Piers Morgan. But it was just the fact that the album was not made for white America. Yep. That caused so much issue, you know, and now you have somebody who comes to one of the cores, you know, a boxing champion of the world doing this kind of stuff. Absolutely insane at that time.
And that's the thing. We see all these people who stand up now and they know they stand up for rights and we do the Black Lives Matter and things of that nature, but they're kind of protected in 2016. Think about Muhammad Ali in 1960s. I mean, he's doing these speeches at colleges, standing up for, you know, the enemy is the white people, you know, things of that nature, because he felt like he was being held down by white people. And you got to understand that. So this is a man who could have been killed at one of these things, way unlike today's society where you're kind of protected with police everywhere. So Hatem, tell me how hard it was for Ali to stand up when it feels like you're the only one against a crowd of people who are against you.
So what's interesting with Muhammad Ali is that at the same time as he was standing up, we had, now I've just literally finished this documentary, so it's fresh in my mind. So OJ Simpson was at a similar time. He just won the Heisman Trophy. So he was another high profile black person around the same time. I think OJ Simpson won it in 68, I believe. So you've got Muhammad Ali saying, "Oh, yeah, civil rights. And then you've got the likes of OJ Simpson saying no. So that's the biggest parallel, is the bravery that Muhammad Ali showed in standing up against the racism. And there weren't, not all black athletes at the time supported him as well. I think Bill Russell, the famous basketball player, supported him. But other than that, they were the lonesome two or three amongst, while OJ Simpson looked at it and said, he just towed the party line. That was a big thing. So for Muhammad Ali to stand up and go, I mean, it's the equivalent now of, I mean, obviously sponsorship now is huge. So it's the equivalent of going against what your sponsors tell you to do and standing up and being political. It doesn't happen anymore. You won't see Floyd doing it. I'd even say you wouldn't even have seen Michael Jordan do it. And for Muhammad Ali to do it at a time, like you said, very militant, like there is the Ku Klux Klan were very, very rampant at those times. It's a miracle he didn't get shot. There was no police protection. I mean, family death threats to him didn't exist. So he's blessed in the way, or we're all blessed that he was able to do that. Because, I mean, like, as you touched on before, the Black Lives Matter, it's a very protected protest. So we've had the police killings, etc. Can you imagine what Muhammad Ali would be doing now if he was around at the same time of a lot of the police killings now? I mean, he was definitely monitored by the CIA. I know that because of his link to the Nation of Islam, he was definitely monitored. I know Malcolm X was wiretapped. So the fact that by association to Malcolm X, that Muhammad Ali was definitely wiretapped also. There's a famous, I think a meeting between Malcolm X and, Muhammad Ali where they met up in, I think it was Ghana, and the FBI were like 10 seconds behind them. So white America, white government was fearful of Muhammad Ali. It's interesting they never tried to take him out because without getting too politically controversial here, in the 60s, if somebody didn't toe the party line, they generally got shot. Malcolm X, Martin Luther King later on, the Kennedy, John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy was showing a bit more, out of all the presidents at the time, he was showing a leaning towards the civil rights movement or at least being more sympathetic. Is it his brother, Robert Kennedy? Or was it his nephew? I can't remember. No, it's his brother, Rob Kennedy. He got shot as well. So it's a miracle in that. I mean, one of the things that Muhammad Ali fights were so packed was because everybody wanted to see this brash Negro lose. And he capitalized on that. But he won people around. Eventually, you couldn't not be captivated by what he said. You couldn't not at least listen to what he said. Initially, when he came out, I mean, I think when he fought Sonny Liston, a lot of people wanted him to be knocked out. I mean, obviously, Sonny Liston had the, I think, Kay, you touched on it, with the mafia and stuff. But the first Sonny Liston fight, he was a massive underdog. And a lot of people came out with the intention of seeing this upstart, brash Negro get battered, basically. And as he said, he shook up the world. There's nothing we can even put a parallel in, Meryl. In this modern world, Serena Williams, I agree, racist. I was at Wimbledon a few years ago when she lost in the quarterfinal to some German woman, and I was just in the toilets, and this old guy comes up and goes, "Oh yeah, we don't want people like her winning. I'm so glad she lost." And I'm like, this is like 2013 or whenever it was, 2013, 2012. And it's amazing that even though we're talking about what he was doing in the 60s and how brave he is, He's still fighting that battle all the way up until his death. Racism is rife. It's probably, I mean, would if Muhammad Ali was around today, would he be saying the same thing? Probably. And he does. And he has. And it's amazing. It takes a lot of courage to stand up against public opinion or majority public opinion or the sponsor's public opinion or our televised public opinion to do what he did. It's unbelievable courage. I mean, he put himself at risk. He put his family at risk. He put all the people around him. But he also had people who, Angelo Dundee got a lot of grief for joining him as well, I believe. Obviously Angelo Dundee stuck with him through thick and thin because of, I mean, there's reasons behind it we'll touch on later, but all his entourage were under pressure. It's huge. I mean, winning the Olympic gold medal should mean that you've worn the United States on your chest. You should be equal. But hey, as we know, and I touched on before, he wasn't equal. He ended up binning the Olympic gold medal in the river, I believe, which led to him being presented to one. Fast forward, it would have been doing the maths, 1996 Olympics. So it's huge. And he is the symbol of racism. I think when he got the Parkinson's disease, there was a deep sigh of relief around white America when it happened. That's very, very controversial, nasty thing to say. But I can say that with good conviction that a lot of people breathed a sigh of relief when he was effectively silenced. Because you can imagine him now through the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. We had the race riots with the O.J. Simpson stuff and then the Rodney King. Can you imagine? I mean, it was a sigh of relief that he was silenced, but he still kept going anyway. You got to love the guy, man.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Kay, talk to me.
Yeah, look, there is... I'm not going to say too much because Hatem has put it brilliantly there. The press hated Ali. They hated him. And words are thrown around now, like media darling and that kind of thing, because he was always there with a, with a, with those amazing quotes that he had. I mean, almost everybody knows an Ali quote. Everybody knows an Ali quote, and there are some absolute gems. But he, you know, he was so pretty. He was so presentable, so eloquent, so clever. You know, the press sort of had to go. What can we even say about that now? It's like if the English didn't like Jurgen Klopp because he was a foreigner, but he says such intelligent things that you just have to sort of go along with it at the moment and hope he stuffs up at some other point later. But that's what it was like. That's what it was like back then. So the big thing I think of all this is when Muhammad Ali stood in front of the court and said, "No Viet Cong ever called me nigger." That was such an immense moment, because I understand it was his religious beliefs, and certainly that was a driving factor, but he was very clearly stating there that this was about conscience. He was always very aware of race. He was always telling black kids to dream, to go bigger, to do something more. And you must remember, after he changed his name to Cassius Clay, it's not like to Muhammad Ali from Cassius Clay. It's not like people just stopped calling him Cassius Clay. They just carried on because they were like, "No, well, that's your name. That's your name. I'm just going to call you that." And, there's a really good quote, after he changed his name from Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali said, "I'm no longer Cassius Clay, a Negro from Kentucky. I belong to the world, the black world. I will always have a home in Pakistan, in Algeria, in Ethiopia. This is more than money." And when he said, "No Viet Cong ever called me money," he was clearly demonstrating his sympathy, his solidarity for brown people all over the world, for people of color all over the world, for black people everywhere, to say, "You can't send us to go kill other black people. It's ridiculous. It doesn't make sense. It will never make sense. And I'm just not going to do it." And what he gave up, in his life for his conscience, he didn't even blink to do it. He thought about it a little bit. It wasn't even a choice for him, it seemed. He was just, that's what he had to do. That was the kind of person he was. And I mean, that's all you need to know about Muhammad Ali. That was the most important time in his boxing career, and he decided to give it up for other people, for people he'd never seen, he will never meet, for people of color like him all over the world who were discriminated and just disavowed and just abused by the system. He said, "This, you cannot stand for that kind of injustice." And that's what he did. Muhammad Ali is an absolute anti-racist champion, and there is literally, there's no other way that history can portray him. It's that big.
It's interesting. Very well said, my friend.
It's interesting that the other sporting icons since Muhammad Ali, I mean, everybody talks about Michael Jordan, and even the current guy, Usain Bolt, never dream of it. If a similar situation came about where he would have to stand up and be controversial, you know that Michael Jordan would never do it, would have never done it. You know, Usain Bolt, as much of a lovable guy as he is, it's changed. They would never do it. Sponsors would have a word in the ear. I think I remember a conversation with an interview with Michael Jordan where he was asked to comment on, what was it? I think he was asked to comment on the Rodney King race riot, and he came up with a quote and said, he was asked whether to condemn white police action or something, or white people's treating with black people. And he said, "Well, hey, they buy my trainers too." I mean, that sums it up, right? That sums up the day, mm-hmm. this day and age of sponsors. Muhammad Ali, Muhammad Ali gave away, he was banned for almost 4 years of his prime. It's the equivalent of a footballer losing the best years of his life. And like you said, he didn't bat an eyelid. Unbelievable. Never happen again. Never would happen.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Not many people would give up that prime years of their career and not complain about it at all. So Anfield Index listeners, if you ain't feeling the emotion in this podcast, I'm not sure you have a pulse. Let's take a quick break and we'll come right back and smash the rest of this.
You're listening to the Anfield Index
podcast channel.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right?
For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
All right, and we're back. This, again, this is the brand new Anfield Index Legends podcast. We're going to continue to talk about Ali. I got two great guests, Kaylin and Hatem. We're going to move on to Muhammad Ali's decision to not go to the Vietnam War. So, Ali had many reasons for not going to the Vietnam War. He's a real stand-up guy, obviously. So, we know that he was banned for boxing. We know he was stripped of his heavyweight title. We know he didn't want to go for religious purposes. When everybody else said, no, he's just afraid to go to war, he doesn't want to go, blah, blah, blah. So, Hatem, talk to me about Ali's decision not to go to the Vietnam War.
The Vietnam War was controversial in itself, and you can see it from his point of view. If I'm not treated as equal by the people that I need to represent in a war, why should I represent them? And white America was looking for any excuse to turn against them anyway, unpatriotic, undemocratic, this and that. So this gave them the perfect... I mean, they tried every method to try to get him enlisted in the first place, and then... And when they did enlist them, I mean, to immense bravery to stand up to the court, and all the lawyers in the world couldn't get him out of it. Unfortunately, you're taking on he took on the United States government, taking on an MP in England. You're talking on the might of the US government. It was a losing battle. There was no way he was ever going to win it. And they knew it. And I think this was their way. I mean, they bled him dry of any finance he did. His act of not going to the Vietnam War meant he was in financial hardship. And what was interesting actually during this, and I know I touched on a little bit earlier with the Nation of Islam and their publicity hungry, having him as the poster boy, they basically faded into obscurity. They didn't back him. They didn't do anything when he was, because even them who are so preach separatism, the white man is the devil, et cetera, et cetera, they couldn't even back him either. And he was basically on his own, fighting the Crusades. I mean, there's obviously the Joe Fraser lent the money during that period, etc. But I mean, to take on it would never happen. I mean, the nearest thing. Imagine how emotional we get when we talk about Hills, when we say, "Oh, like effectively the families of '96 took on the government, took on the establishment." I mean, I'm not putting them similar, but this is in the '60s. It was unheard of to do that. What the government told you to do, you did. It was, everybody was a conformist. And as I touched before, he lost the most prime part of his year doing this, but he was he knew that he couldn't back down. He got himself in a situation where the moment he said, "No Viet Cong ain't call me nigger," the real people that I'm fighting against are the ones that call me nigger back home. The moment he said that, there was no turning back. I don't think for any second he would have wanted to turn back, but that was it. It was set in stone. I'm fighting this. I mean, they stopped short of jailing him. I know he got sentenced to 5 years in prison. I think he got fined, I think it was $10,000, which in those days was like huge. And obviously the boxing board, who were already pretty much against him anyway, decided what better way to do? Let's just ban him for 3 years anyway. So, I mean, it was hot. How many people do that? Putting aside sportsmen, I don't know anybody who would actually give up their career, their livelihood. And he was well documented on his number of wives and children. So he's putting his family, and he had a ton of hangers on as well. So he's putting them all of their welfare at risk for this to prove a point, and a very salient point as well. And people initially, even those that were the most vocal against him, suddenly came to admire. You can't not but admire. Eventually, you have to admire him. And the sentiment against the Vietnam War was growing and growing and growing, to the point that they all knew he was right in the end anyway. The Vietnam War was wrong. Everybody knows it was wrong. And nobody had the courage to say it. Along came a black guy. Because it was a black man who said it, it's like, oh, he's undemocratic. He's not a nationalist. He's not. It's so un-American to do. Imagine if a white man had said it, right? I don't think any of the issue would have happened. I'm trying to think of any of the white icons that would have around at the same time. I can't offhand think of it. If a white person had said what he said, I don't think it would have been met with the furore that it was met. I don't think they would have been sentenced to prison. I don't think they would have been banned from their respective sport or job. He brought a lot of hatred out, but that act of him sticking out the conscription basically targeted a lot of black hate onto him. So he diverted a lot of black hate onto him. And he became the beacon for racism towards him as well, which is another brave thing to do as well. Because he just became like white racists at the time were like, oh, Muhammad Ali, Muhammad Ali. It became such an insult to them and everything they stood for. It was brilliant to see them all just basically, because when the war eventually ended, every one of those people who vilified him knew that he was right in the end anyway. It's just that he had to sacrifice so much just to prove a point.
Yeah, no doubt. It's such a hard, Vietnam War was such a polarizing topic, and Muhammad Ali is actually one man himself. How he had the courage to do this, I'll never know, but you stand up against it. And as you said, Hatem, as a black man, this is not a white man doing this. This is a man who knows so much hate thrown his way, and he still stood up to it. Didn't think for a second what the consequences were. So, Kay, what's your opinion now?
I don't have that much to add to Hatem's stuff. It was absolutely amazing. I think, you know, the only small thing I can add was when Ali was drafted, basically his choice was this. Don't go. You will not be going anywhere near the front line. Basically, you have to do a couple of exhibition bouts for our troops, get the morale up, or you could go to jail. This is literally like somebody offering you cake or jail, and you chose jail. You know, because it's what you stand for. It's an absolutely incredible decision for somebody to do it. I mean, on the day that he was sentenced, the U.S. Congress voted to extend the draft by 4 more years. This, you know, it was extremely significant in what happened. I'll just end on a quote, but this is how the man himself saw the problem. It wasn't a matter of fighting for your country, because that's not what it was. It wasn't a matter of going to jail or not going to jail. These are Ali's own words. I strongly object to the fact that so many newspapers have given the American public and the world the impression that I have only two alternatives in this stand. Either go to jail or go to the army. There is another alternative, and that alternative is justice. If justice prevails, if my constitutional rights are upheld, I will be forced to go neither to the army nor to jail. In the end, I am confident that justice will come my way, for the truth must eventually prevail. That man was looking at this and saying, like, sort of, we're in a democracy. This is supposed to be a democracy. I'm supposed to have constitutional rights. I'm supposed to be able to choose my own path in life. I'm not able to. That is incorrect. That is not democracy. That is something else. He saw way past what people were giving him credit for at the time. And he was called a draft dodger. He was called a number of really ugly things at the time. And as Hatem said, just absolutely threw away, you know, we lost prime years of perhaps one of the, you know, definitely one of the greatest boxers we've ever seen in the world. We lost that because you know, we wanted to go disenfranchise another people at some point. It's absolutely crazy, you know, and for him to stand up and do that, mind blowing at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. When you think of Muhammad Ali, just the name fills you with emotion, fills you with pride. Like, that's what I want to strive for. If I could be a little tiny, a quarter of the person he was or the things that he did, it's amazing. He, you know, the man lived till he was 74. And he did so much in his life, it almost makes me feel like I'm failing. But let's move on and talk about Ali's philanthropic, if I could speak, work. Now, Muhammad Ali made a lot. He was a lot to many different people. He dedicated his time, his money to so many different things. So, okay, talk to me about his lasting legacy on the world. And all the charities he was involved with. That's what I want to hear about.
He was, I mean, this was quite crazy. So, I mean, I'm just trying to open up the notes I have on his fights, but this is the immensity to which Muhammad Ali was dedicated to a group of people. And not many people know this about Ali, but the income that he generated he never thought of it as like his per se. It was more his responsibility. And even from the time when he was fighting, he was really doing a lot of philanthropic stuff. But he had obviously an entourage, but a greater community that he was supporting. And I mean, really, if we look at his fighting career, we can see that, you know, his last fight really against Joe Frazier, that's Joe Frazier 3, that happened. And really, maybe he should have retired then. And we see him come out into the ring. And this is incredibly heartbreaking part of Muhammad Ali's career. It's very difficult for me to put that into words. I don't know, maybe I can do that with a little story, but when the Rumble in the Jungle was going on, and it's very difficult for us to appreciate now because we know that he won and we know Muhammad Ali is one of the greatest boxers we've ever seen. But George Foreman was unbelievable. He was like a god. He was like a boxing god. He was too fast, relative to his size. He would get you in the corner and batter you. He would demolish you, right? And when he was fighting Muhammad Ali, my father and my grandfather were listening on the radio, and my grandfather was really restless. He was standing up and walking around. He'd come and sit down and then he couldn't. He'd get up and walk around a little bit more and then come back. And my father didn't know what was going on. He'd never seen my grandfather like that. And it got to a sort of, you know, about the fifth round. And that was like, you know, at the height of when Foreman was just absolutely taking Ali, you know, not beating him, but battering him. It was like hitting on a slab of meat all the time. And my dad followed my grandfather to see what he was doing. And my grandfather was going away to cry. He was crying because he thought Muhammad Ali would die that day. He thought George Foreman would kill Muhammad Ali that day. And that's how much he meant. And so, I mean, he carries on boxing, obviously. He finishes Joe Frazier. What follows are 10 fights. 10 fights he possibly never should have been in. And one of the reasons I think is he carried on fighting is because he had to sustain, you know, many different groups of people after he really should have stopped fighting. You know, it's just a really sad story, especially when you look at what the condition he started getting into after those fights and you know, being hospitalized and stuff like that. But obviously the Alzheimer's thing he's been a very good contributor to that. But I think most of his, I'll let Hatem talk about his former stuff in a little while. I think his sort of greatest contribution to all that is just the informal way that he would support people. And, you know, besides his formal stuff, the informal ways that he supported those communities, that he would, just be there to keep his entourage going, to make sure that everybody around him had enough. That was absolutely incredible to me, you know, and, like I say, I could talk about this forever, but I'm going to let Hatem take over from here.
See, it's funny you touch on the entourage. And for me, I blame that entourage for making him fight those 10 fights.
Mm.
My late, like, one of the fights I remember, and I remember seeing a documentary about it, is when he fought Larry Holmes. Larry Holmes was his sparring partner.
His sparring partner.
And Larry Holmes, out of respect for Muhammad Ali, didn't want to knock him out. It was awful to watch. And this was when I used to say to my dad, oh, this is the Muhammad Ali you're talking about. And he'd be like, look, this is the Muhammad Ali I'm talking about, and show me the various things about him. He had an entourage, and that's why he fought longer. He shouldn't, I mean, what's even more depressing is that he fought one more time after Larry Holmes, where those 10 fights. I mean, one of the things he was selling the fight was with the Joe Frazier fight. Thriller Manila, the third fight, was that this is, come and see me. This is the last time you're going to see me fight. This is going to last. Mm. And if only he'd stopped. If only, I mean, that's one of the big, I mean, Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali, obviously, Joe Frazier went to his grave hating Muhammad Ali. It's interesting because Muhammad Ali was around at a boxing era where every amazing boxers, Ken Norton, George Foreman, Joe Frazier, etc. And one of the things that Joe Frazier was jealous about was that Muhammad Ali basically got all the attention, but Muhammad Ali used it well. He helped, he spoke out on just about every issue. It's quite any issue. Muhammad Ali would be like almost like now you get the idiots on, like the social media, like the likes of Piers Morgan commenting on stuff. He became a spokesman on anything race related anywhere in the world. Muhammad Ali would be talking through that. He had his charities. And he was revered so much in terms of, I mean, would have been the Gulf War would have been, what, 25 years ago? So that would have been the first Gulf War. Saddam Hussein took some hostages. Who was the only one? The guy, I mean.
Do you know, Hatem, about that, apparently what happened is that like, literally Muhammad Ali walks into the room and there's Saddam Hussein, and Saddam Hussein talks to him a little bit. And then at some point they get to, yeah, but Saddam, you have to, no, we let them go. No problem. Where can we drop them off for you? And stuff like that. Like Saddam Hussein himself couldn't, he already admitted to himself like a while back, he was not going to say no to Muhammad Ali. So he might as well use the time to get to know him a little bit better. Like, absolutely incredible.
As soon as, the story goes from, like, again, it might be urban legend again, but the story goes that when Saddam Hussein was fairly, he was adamant, I ain't releasing anybody, get out my country, blah, 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 blah. And even the people, the entourage of George Bush's presidency were like, look, this is a pointless thing. We're not going to guarantee your safety. This is nothing. Muhammad Ali was like, look, I still think I can make a difference. These are brown people. This is an unjust war. I think I can reason with them. And the senator around him were like, what's the point? This is obviously some propaganda stunt by Saddam Hussein. I guarantee you Saddam Hussein's going to go meet Muhammad Ali, pose from her a picture, send it to his people and say, look, even Muhammad Ali backs me and nothing's going to happen. And exactly as you touched on, Saddam Hussein, I don't think for any minute actually believed that Muhammad Ali was actually going to go there. He turns up, he's like, he was completely in awe. I mean, considering that this guy was the enemy of the alleged free world at the time, for him to do that is huge. It doesn't get the... I mean, it's interesting, of all the acts he's done, this doesn't get as much publicity as it should. I mean, we're talking a dictator. I mean, God, I mean, imagine what he could have done with. And I think, again, it might be a bit controversial again, but I think when the government saw that much power he got, they wouldn't ask for him. We've had similar situations since then. We've had Gulf War II, the sequel. We've had several other unjust stuff. He spoke about 9/11. He could have, he spoke, again with the anti-Islamic stuff, 9/11. He wasn't used as much again after that, after the releasing of the hostages, because again, white America got, this guy's got Parkinson's disease and yet he's still able to influence this. This is huge. They don't want him being a massive figure again. They're kind of thinking, oh God, I thought we'd silenced him. I thought he'd already been silenced now, but this was a huge thing. I mean, he risked his life. I think the Americans didn't afford him any protection. They said, you go on your own, your own accord, and whatever happens to you, you're on your own. You get shot, you get hostage, and we're not going to do anything for you. That's huge. We're talking, I mean, this is how many years after he's, I mean, when was the Gulf War? When was the Gulf War again? 25 years?
94.
94. 94. So, Yeah, so he'd retired. I mean, he'd officially retired in 81. So we're talking 15 years ago, 15 years from his boxing career ending. And he's still able to influence people. I mean, he did a lot for the Islamic world. He fought a lot. He became an icon. And even for the younger generation, especially with a lot of the things, the unfortunate situations that have happened with obviously 9/11 and the various situations, he always comes out and says that these terrorists do not speak for my religion the same way that Hitler does not speak for yours. And he comes up with stuff like that. That's amazing. And it's good because through all the Islamophobia or the hatred towards, just as it was during the time, I'm sure the same sort of thing with the anti-black racism during the 60s as well. Black people, as well as Muslim people now, just look at them and say, wow, you don't have to stick up for us. And yet you're doing it. You're putting everything on the line. And he will always be listened to. He won the respect of the world during his stance on the Vietnam. So now when Muhammad Ali says something about a particular issue, it could be about anything from a football match to, I don't know, a cookery class. He gets listened to. It's amazing, man. I mean, he got over the division between you have sportsmen, you have politicians. He got rid of that division. A sportsman he was civil rights. He was sport. He was politics. He was comedy. I mean, Michael Parkinson interviews with him. Some of the stuff he said about Islamic women and when they were questioned about it, like hijab and stuff like that. Some of the stuff he said it in a way that got people to listen and got people to educate. It's a shame, man, because like, and this is going to sound quite emotional, but the Islamic world could still do with him now. And it's a shame he's gone, to be honest. And Black America could definitely do with him, given what's going on with what's going on. Can you imagine him plus Black Lives Matter at the moment? Can you imagine him plus the anti-Islamic stuff that's going on? Wow. It's a shame. Like, he's just been taken from us a bit too early. But it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And like, I can't even pronounce, is it philanthropy? This is going to be the
philanthropy.
Philanthropic, yeah. We're all having a problem with that.
let's go with charity.
That's good.
I mean, he gave a lot of his money. He looked after, I mean, it's well documented. A lot of haters will say, oh yeah, he's a womanizer, but he looked after them all, man. Of course, the Daily Mail, blessed. I mean, I don't know what do in America. We have the Daily Mail, which is pretty much a right wing bullshit extremist paper.
Yep.
And it's funny, on the day that Muhammad Ali died, they posted a picture saying, oh, there's one of Muhammad Ali's sons wasn't looked after. He was cut. He was cut from his family and he didn't look after him. Mm. When Muhammad Ali, it was known, a lot of kids, he did look after him. He did. He was just Muhammad. Like, initially, the kid didn't back his whole stance, and he did things wrong to Muhammad Ali. There was aspects of his life. And outside of that, when he passed away, it was an amazing outpouring of grief. And it was, we all knew it was coming, right? Because he'd been ill a couple of times. I went to sleep on that Friday night knowing, man, and like we talked about it that night and said, look, I think this is really it. And when waking up to that was just like everybody in the world was devastated. I mean, charities around the world, like anti-racism, anti-poverty charities, lost their beacon. It's like it was the lighthouse amongst all the hate in the world. He was the lighthouse, and it's there'll never be another, man. It's a shame that people like the Usain Bolts and the Michael Jordans and the Floyd Mayweathers, unfortunately, have got similar fame, but they just abused it, man.
No, you're absolutely right, Hot Time. We need more people like Muhammad Ali in this world. You're not going to have Muhammad Ali. You just can't replicate people, but you bring up a good point about the high profile colored athletes, black athletes. Michael Jordan's never spoke out. Usain Bolt, like you said, lovable guy. They're not going to hit them hard topics because they don't have that kind of, hey, somebody's going to come at me if I say something controversial. I'm not sure how to deal with that. And that's the thing with Ali. You know, this was all him. This is a brilliant man. This is a brilliant man coming up with these responses, all these quotes. He didn't have anybody writing this stuff for him. He was a man who'd stand up there, wax lyrical about what he believed in. No matter who thought about it, no matter who cared, didn't matter. That's the kind of guy he was. So.
And Joey, one of the most amazing things was interviews would start being about boxing. And a very, very short time they'd be about boxing. And then he'd move on to different things. He could speak to people in a way that was just so culturally relevant. The Parkinson one was great because I thought Parkinson kept on trying to pull the interview back to some place he could stand on again. And Ali just would never allow him to do that. He kept on pushing it into places that were uncomfortable. He did this all the time. He would go to universities and speak to the students there about what was happening and stuff like that. This was, you know, it's so rare to come across somebody who understood his importance in the world and what he could do, and then actually used that importance to try and do something greater than himself. You know, it's like Atim says, a rare breed. And I honestly, I don't know, like Atim says, if we're ever going to see somebody like that again.
I mean, it's interesting. I know O.J. Simpson's been done to death recently with a spate of documentaries, but if you watch the ESPN one, which is rather than a celebrity BBC one that was produced, the People Versus, there's a section in there that compares. I mean, O.J. Simpson was a massive, as big an icon as Muhammad Ali at the time, with the Heisman Trophy, the college football trophy, and they compared the two lives, and how Muhammad Ali still fought against everybody saying, no, you can't do this. You can't do it. You're an athlete. You can't be this controversial. Mm. O.J. Simpson. No, no, no. He was even asked his views on Muhammad Ali's draft dodging. And he was like, oh, well, if I get drafted, I lay allegiance to the American flag. And that was just unbelievable, man. It's just like you go against the reasons Muhammad Ali didn't win were clearly for race relations. And I mean, Muhammad Ali, do you watch build-ups to fights? Everything, all these build-ups, all these hypes and hyped up fights, like they're all because of how he did it. He would sell a fight. And it will never happen again, man. It'll never happen again. Everything now is fake compared. He genuinely believed he was selling the fights.
Yeah, absolutely right. He was a real, real guy, genuine. And again, no one will be like him. Now, gentlemen, I would love to talk about this for a few more hours. I know we are on a time limit, so I do have a few questions for you guys to end this. So I'll start with Hatem. You can go first, and I'll start with the first question. What was your all-time favorite Ali fight?
In terms of quality, I would say Thriller in Manila. In terms of significance, it has to be Rumble in the Jungle. The reason is, I mean, to have a world title fight in Africa, to have a world title fight in the Philippines, never be done. Never will be done ever again. It has to be Vegas, as you guys know. The significance of he united a continent, and the whole story behind it is amazing. But the fight itself for me is Thriller in Manila. Just because you see two guys driven on, going to the limits of humanity to win a fight. I mean, the build up to the Rumble in Jungle was like legendary. Unfortunately, the build up to Thriller Manila wasn't. It was very nasty, and I think Joe Frazier left a lot. In fact, Muhammad Ali also left a lot in the ring that day. I mean, we're talking 15 rounds, man. Now people do 12. Mm. These are 15 rounds, and that fight, Muhammad Ali made one of his biggest mistakes of taking Frazier lightly in that fight. He thought after he'd beaten him, after he'd equalized his, avenged his previous defeat, that Frazier had nothing left. Frazier was driven on by the hatred of one of the worst things you can say to a black guy. It's ironic that I touched on O.J. Simpson being the ultimate, but is the Uncle Tom, and that's the worst thing that any black guy can say to another black guy. And those words ate Joe Frazier, and those words drove Frazier to push Muhammad Ali to the point of, I mean, the score. There's two legendary stories about that. I mean, going into the 15th round, I think the two, three previous rounds before it, Joe Frazier's trainer was telling him he's going to stop the fight. And the story goes that Muhammad Ali was going to, in the interval between the 14th and the 15th round, Muhammad Ali was telling Angelo Dundee to cut his gloves. He had nothing left. Mm. And out of the corner of the eye, Eddie Futch, Joe Frazier's legendary trainer, basically cut Joe Frazier's gloves. Joe Frazier was blind already at one eye, and he couldn't see out the other one. You think he was blind at one eye going into the fight, and his other eye was completely closed, so he decided to make the decision for the safety of his fighter to pull him out. So we never know if Eddie Futch didn't have the interests of his fighter at heart, whether Muhammad Ali would have quit that fight. But Muhammad Ali was not as magnanimous in victory as he was after as he was after his previous fights. He collapsed, I believe, and it's a shame, man. If only. So it's symbolic. If only he'd quit after that fight, we'd still have him now.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, even Ali said after the Thrill in Manila, which is actually my favorite fight as well, he said that's the closest I've ever come to death. I mean, Joe Frazier had a punch like none other. But the point you brought up there, which I loved, is that the animosity that Ali just laid on him. I mean, it was so... To call a black man an Uncle Tom, I don't know if you can get much worse. And that was hurtful to Frazier. Frazier, I know, grew up in Beaufort, South Carolina, but lived the majority of his life where I live. So he's always has a special place, but that was a great point for you to bring up. Now, Kay, how about yourself, man?
Oh, there's so many big fights. I mean, the fights dot Ali's life, you know, and you tend to remember them for different reasons. I'm just trying to, you know, think of all the unbelievable ones, and like the Sonny Liston Phantom Punch. Oh my God, what a punch. You know, that was absolutely incredible. Think of Cleveland Big Cat Williams. That was probably Ali's best fight. It was at the absolute peak of his power. I think I saw a stat once where like Muhammad Ali went 260 something punches without having one thrown back at him during that fight. Absolutely ridiculous. That was the fight that you see the vines going around where he's dodging all the punches and stuff. Ernie Terrell, where he called him Cassius Clay before the fight. And that was Ali's most brutal, he refused to knock Ernie Terrell out and kept on saying, "What's my name, boy?" So that was unbelievable. Obviously, Rumble in the Jungle, but I'm going to go with you guys as well. There was also that fight. He ended up losing it, but he broke his jaw. Was that to Norton?
Yes. Norton.
Ken Norton. Yep.
That was unbelievable fight. What the hell? He broke his jaw like so early in the fight, and he just kept on fighting. That went the distance. That fight. How can you fight like many rounds with a broken jaw? That's absolutely ridiculous. But it's got to be Thrill in Manila. It's. I don't know if we have another sporting equivalent of that. We're two huge forces, and this is the thing that makes Ali great in boxing, is that he was a great amongst greats. Frazier's a really good guy. Let me just tell you that. Frazier actually lent Ali money when he came out of prison. So, you know, not a lot of people know that. And the movie Ali actually set a lot of people onto that one. But, you know, after that, especially to be called a gorilla, you know, that was one of the things I really didn't like about what Ali did. He since apologized and said he was scared and stuff like that. But, you know, to do that to people was, especially a black man, was just, you know, it was... You look back now and you can feel the regret, and they both regret. They've obviously made up since, but it was that one. I mean, after the fight, Ali just doesn't come out. It takes hours. It takes hours before he faces the press. And when he does, it's so subdued. He's just, and you can see everything was left in that ring. To go up against another great and have a fight like that. It's, I mean, wow. Wow, wow, wow. That's that, I mean, literally, we can only do movies about that now. That's the hugeness to which it happened. If you wrote a movie like that, people go, yeah, but it's a movie. But that it happened then, where you had these behemoths, these titans coming out against each other, taking each other absolutely to the cleaners, and both coming out, you know, slightly broken, I think you'd call that. But, yeah, it's gotta be Frazier, the Thrill in Manila.
Not to mention the heat and humidity in Manila as well. I mean, apparently it was supposed to be 100 degrees at the ringside as well. And I mean, one of the sad things is that when Frazier died, he took his hatred of Muhammad. I mean, Muhammad Ali tried to build bridges with Joe Frazier before he passed away. And, I think he used to come up with stuff like, if I was to go to war, I'd have Joe Frazier by my side. He tried to build up, but unfortunately, I mean, I watched a documentary about Joe Frazier's death, and he was practically gloating the fact that Muhammad Ali's condition was down to his hands. during the Thrill of Manila fight, which is quite sad to see. And again, I mean, none of us will ever understand the hatred of an Uncle Tom being called an Uncle Tom. He carried that towards the end, and it was once they both retired, once like all of them retired. I mean, Foreman was more likable character, and he'd found religion, and he then had his Foreman grill, et cetera, et cetera. Muhammad Ali had his philanthropy. Got it right.
Yeah.
Joe Frazier had nothing. He died practically broke. And there was a bit of bitterness towards Ali from that, as well as the Uncle Tom comment. And he's got this ringtone where he says, it's horrible to quote, but he says, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Something like, I can still do certain things. Look at me. As in, he's having a dig at Ali and saying, well, look. Look at the other. I think it was a float like butterfly, sling like a bee. Look at the other one. Now look at me, or something like that. That's not an exact quote. So, but it was words along that, as in, look, hey, at least I've still got my ability to be able to. It's a shame as well, because they each one of them made each other. They wouldn't have been. Yeah. Muhammad Ali needed Joe Frazier, needed Joe Foreman, all three of them, and then you add Ken Norton. What an era, man. And you laugh at the era we've got at the moment, where we've got Anthony Joshua, David Haye, and Tyson Fury, and everybody's talking about it being a great era for heavyweight boxing. It just depresses me, man.
Yeah, no, those are great points. I mean, it's those two. When some a lot of times when warriors fight, you get that kind of after. You know, it's natural. Both things on each party are not good things said. So, okay, tell me your favorite Ali quote.
My favorite Ali quote was, I believe it was before the Jerry Quarry fight, but this one sort of always stayed with me. I've got a little meme of it that I keep on my computer as well, but it's, nobody has to tell me that this is a serious business. I'm not fighting one man. I'm fighting a lot of men, showing a lot of them. Here's one man they couldn't defeat. They couldn't conquer. My mission is to bring freedom to 30 million black people. And I mean, coming out of apartheid South Africa, that is the kind of comment. I mean, my father, you know, just to explain the significance of that to me, my father says there are maybe, you know, the two greatest influences in his life, probably Nelson Mandela, and he doesn't really know which one's bigger. He's going to give it to Mandela just based on the politics and what he did for us, you know, as a South African, obviously, but he says Muhammad Ali was, you know, it was so significant. It was so big what he did and how he used what he got. That it's difficult to not say he's the biggest influence on people's lives. And don't let anybody tell you that sport doesn't matter, or that this is sport and we should leave the politics out and all that kind of thing. Those two things are the same thing. They'll always be the same thing. Everything has everything to do with politics. So, but yeah, Jerry, that is my favorite quote.
That's coming from your father, who was involved in that apartheid, is really hard hitting, man. I can't stress that enough. So, Hatem, how about your favorite quote?
He's had many, but I think the one that resonates with me the most is the one where he said, "A man who views the world the same at 50 as he did at 20 has wasted 30 years of his life." That basically sums up his entire life, how he changed and realized that what he was doing at 20, boxing, what he was doing growing, you can't waste your life, because at any moment it can be gone. And all these, and it's pretty much a dig at, like, if you compare it to all the boxers now, if you look at Floyd sitting there doing his money team and just gloating and showing how much money he's got, he's not actually doing anything with his life. He's still acting like a kid in this time. I mean,
but also at that time, Hatem, I mean, you had Sonny Liston coming out from that kind of culture of, you know, just opulence. And then obviously towards the end of his career, when Don King came in, that level, I mean, those are, you know, you could say he'd carry them with him, just to, even at the time, it just looks like we haven't learned anything. Basically everybody's the same.
Yep, basically.
Don King's still here.
Oh god, don't get me started on Don King. Yeah. killed basically screwed Ali. I mean, Rumble in the Jungle made Don King, right? Nobody had heard of him, and I wish it had. I mean,
I would love to know what Ali told him in the ring at the end of that fight. He whispers something in his ear, and I'd love to know
about that. Before, he's been asked about that and still never said.
He won't say it, will he?
No. Nope. No, he will not. So, well, I picked there's so many quotes from Ali, obviously both you guys know, but one that really, I mean, I have a book of quotes from Ali, but one that I really like was he said, "War is against the teachings of the Quran. I'm not trying to dodge the draft. We are not supposed to take part in no wars unless declared by Allah or the Messenger. We don't take part in Christian wars or wars of any believers. Man, I ain't got no quarrel with them Viet Cong. Why should they ask me to put on a uniform and go 10,000 miles from home and drop bombs and bullets on brown people in Vietnam, while so-called Negro people in Louisville are treated like dogs and denied simple human rights?" If that doesn't sum up Muhammad Ali, I'm not sure what else does.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean,
it's just, and that's, and people, you know, think about today where people prepare speeches. This man just got up in front of a mic and spoke what he felt from his heart. And that's really difficult to do. You can say it to yourself, but to say that on national TV or in front of a group of people, a massive group of people, is just really difficult. And he'll always amaze me. I mean, he just will. There's only certain people who touch you and you go, man, like that's an amazing person. Everybody has their faults. Everybody. Nobody is exempt from that. But his positives far outweigh his negatives. So, guys, I got one last question for you. Hatem, I'll start with you. Ali's toughest opponent ever.
I'm not going to go with a boxing opponent. So I'm going to go with the establishment, I'm going to say from the establishment covers the U.S. government. It covers U.S. public opinion. It covers white America. It covers Nation of Islam. It also covers himself. I mean, he actually squashed that. His toughest opponent was himself. And I think he lost the battle against himself because he went on boxing too long. And for me, that's the saddest thing. He felt the need that he had to look after his hangers-on. And it does sicken me when I see the likes of Pacheco and Dundee and that Drew Bundini do their talk, give their eulogies after he passed away. And I think for me, the toughest opinion was himself, because if he'd listened to other people, he wouldn't have gone on for that long. This is strictly from it not going on boxing too long. Again, having an opponent as strong as yourself also helped him with the other stuff as well. It helped him get through the three to four year ban when he wasn't allowed to box. But I honestly think that his determination to look after people other than himself and put other people first is what cost him, which got him his illness, and which, again, he listened to his, I mean, he didn't need to fight 10 fights, man. His hangers-on decided. If I was to criticize one act that he did, when he resumed boxing again after the ban, why did he go back with the Nation of Islam? Because he felt loyal to them. And again, it's fairly on a depressing note, but I mean, it's easy to say Joe Frazier. It's easy to say, which I even started off saying the government, but I think thinking about it a bit more, it's himself and the advantage of putting himself before others became his downfall in the end, because he thought he had to fight on to feed. I mean, Bundini was nothing without him. I think didn't Bundini try and sell something when he was broke? I think he sold something to one of, didn't he try and sell one of Ali's belts or something? The black guy who, came up with all the quotes for Ali. He should have cut him off. He felt a loyalty to him. He felt a loyalty to fight on, to feed him. And for me, that's his biggest opponent. It's a bit of a weird one. I know it goes against the norm, but I think if he put himself first a little towards the end of his career, he wouldn't have fought on, man. He would have stopped. He would have stopped after the Joe Frazier fight in Manila. We would have had, I mean, he fought on for six more years. Six more years when his brain's already battered. I don't think.
And he was slow, noticeably slower, slower, you know.
One of the worst things you saw was the Parkinson's sequence of interviews and how he started off but I guess he felt he had to do it for others, and that sadly became his downfall, man. Again, it's one of the other side of the coin is it's his greatest trait as well, right?
Yeah, and I know you think that's a weird answer. I actually think that's an amazing answer. I can hear the pain in your voice having to answer that question.
It's horrible, so, man. It's horrible. Yeah, it's like in all these interviews and all these, like, the Pachecos and the Angelo Dundees. Oh, Muhammad, why didn't you tell him to stop? You knew he had Parkinson's. You knew he was slurring. You knew he was slower. You knew it, but yeah, you still allowed it, man. And my blood boils when I see Pacheco as well, who's allegedly the team doctor, man. That whenever I see him, it just winds me up when I see his name on the screen giving a tribute. Muhammad Ali. It's like, mate, you're the
doctor. And do you know sort of what makes it worse is, if we look at Rumble in the Jungle, literally in the locker room before the fight, Ali has his entire corner around him. Angelo Dundee says, it's this and I'm out, man. Like, literally, I think you're going to kill yourself. Please don't do the fight. Please don't do the fight. And Ali says, you know, I got it. I got this. Don't worry. His entire corner, before the fight, Ali has to say, guys, you have to pick your faces up from the floor. At least pretend, you know, none of them believed in him. What's the use of having a corner if none of your entourage believe in you, you know? And then you want to go from that to, yeah, have 10 fights more or however many fights more that, you know, it's absolutely, I mean, I can only agree with that, Tim. They're just incredible, incredibly nasty stuff.
All right, gentlemen, you guys absolutely smashed that pod. I could not have asked for better guest. Honest to God, it was really good. It was my first time hosting. So I'll tell you what, why don't we give some plugs? Hatem, I'll start with you. I know you have a brand new show out on Anfield Index.
So we looked at the Anfield Index. We looked and we thought, well, the Middle Eastern point of view is not represented. So me and my close friends, based dotted around Middle East and London, did a Liverpool podcast called The Oilfield Index. We've done our pilot episodes, and it should be on the app ready to download. It's quite interesting. It was great fun to record. And yeah, hopefully we give you guys a different point of view on everything Liverpool.
Awesome. Okay, I know you're just about everywhere, my friend. Anything anything you want to plug, pal?
Yes, thanks, Joey. Firstly, excellent job hosting. Much better than I could do it. So, absolutely stunning job. Really, really enjoyed that pod. Guys, you can catch me on Face Off, which happens after every game. We just finished the one against Burnley, which is out, you know, by the time this one will come out, that one will be out. I start doing the main AI pod as I alternate hosting duties with Marco Lopez, so you should also be getting that one out soon. And then if I could just put a quick shout out to my boy Roy, and he's starting his Talking Tactics pod. The introduction pod is out now, so do go check that out.
Yeah, congrats to everybody who has new shows on Anfield Index. Download the app. Everybody who is involved with AI are really cool people. They're up for debate. You know, hit everybody up on Twitter. I myself, Joe Connors, I do a little bit with the AI Comic Pod writing. I do pods here and there. But I just want to say, again, this is the inaugural Legends Anfield Index pod. So anybody who's interested, hit Gags up. He's a great guy. On that note, you guys have a wonderful day, and thank you again for my guest. We'll talk to you soon.
The champ is here! The champ is here!
Like a butterfly, sting like a bee.
This is destiny. Don't have to worry,
he will be mine in round 9. And if he makes me sore, I'll cut it to 4.
Thank you very much.
And
thank
if that don't do, we'll get him in 2. If he run, we'll get him in 1. And in your heart, you know I'm right.
I'm young.
I'm handsome, I'm fast, I'm pretty, and can't possibly be beat. I am the greatest.
You better fight this boy Cooper. You've been playing around for a long time, reporting it as you
yes,
say.
Yes, I'm not training too hard for this bum. In the Cooper's nothing to me. This bum going over 5 rounds.
Liston receives the congratulations to the victor, scorns Cassius Clay, who's heard to say, Liston's not great, he'll fall in eight.
I saw Sonny Liston a few days ago, Cassius.
Ain't he ugly? He's too ugly to be the world champ. The world champ should be pretty like me.
This will be the biggest contest in the history of Cuba. And if you like to lose your mind, be a fool and bear on fire.
I don't have a mark on my face, and I upset Sonny Liston, and I just turned 22 years old. I must be the greatest. I told the world, I talk to God every day. If God's with me, can't nobody be against me. I shook up the world. I shook up the world. I am the king of the world.
Hold it.
I'm pretty.
Hold it. You're not that pretty.
I'm a bad man.
Wait.
I shook up the world.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.